Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. It's a boisterous new kid on the media block at an active corner in the coronavirus conversation. People get there on Google's YouTube channel on the internet. The stream of videos can have a compelling voice, a documentary look, lots of added effects, and typically the feel of a hard sell. Lots of people hear it as propaganda. Lots of others hear a galvanizing truth. It can sound like this sample from a video piece called Plandemic.
For exposing their deadly secrets, the minions of Big Pharma waged war on Dr. Michalowicz, destroying her good name, career, and personal life.
I was held in jail with no charges. I was called a fugitive from justice.
It centers on a sometime government scientist, Judy Michalowicz, who holds a host of villains responsible for planning or planting the coronavirus. Anthony Fauci, the government doctor, is at the top of her list, along with Bill Gates, the embodiment of digital power and money, also Big Pharma, China, and the very idea of globalism. We're talking this hour, comparing notes, on a rough and tough struggle to tell the story of the age. Question, is anybody delivering the coronavirus news straight in daily print, on cable, or now on the freelance fringe video market? And why doesn't the general public have access to a consensus version yet? The journalist Anna Merlin is going to give us her meticulous fact check of the Plandemic video, which she undertook for Vice Online. The decorated documentarian Errol Morris, famous hound of truth, lies, and the fog of war, is going to review some of the YouTube work. We begin with Jay Rosen of New York University, regarded by many and by me as a sort of conscience of straight journalism as we used to know it. I was looking for the context of our confusion. Jay, here we are in coronavirus time. Biggest shock to the system, it's been said, since World War II, and we have no common story of what's to do, where we are, what it's about. How can this be?
Well, in a ordinary time with a regular administration and a president like the presidents we've had since Roosevelt, we would be expected to be arguing about grappling with the president's plan for getting us out of this mess. But now we have a president whose plan is to have no plan and then create confusion about who is responsible for that as 1,000 to 3,000 people a day lose their lives. That is so far beyond our expectations of how a political system would work and what the commander-in-chief is for that it creates a kind of paralysis in the system.
You and I have shared some of these YouTube videos. It's a genre now. Fake documentaries, a lot of them. How do we account for the growth of their numbers, their popularity, even their belief?
Networks, platforms like Facebook are exquisitely sensitive to the demand for something to be true. And they reward political actors and advertisers for responding to that demand. And whenever I try to talk about Facebook and journalism, I always start with one simple fact that's incredibly obvious but decisive to me, which is that people's responses to propaganda and made-up stories and fictions and lies are just as useful for targeting ads as their responses to true stories and real journalism. This is a fact about Facebook. This is a fact about the internet, if you will. The system is exquisitely tuned to measuring and registering demand for political illusions. And when that happens, the suppliers of political illusions will notice that and they will supply.
Jay, when I look at these YouTube so-called documentaries, and the comments and the numbers that they attract, what strikes me is that there's a massive militant force of disbelief in our world suddenly.
Yeah.
Where did it come from and who's responsible?
I don't know that we know where it came from. I mean, part of it was that it could have been always there, but there wasn't a system for sustaining it and bringing it to the individual person's attention. A lot of the authority that the legacy media had was not a result of its brilliant performance at telling us the truth and connecting with its audience. It was simply a result of the limited number of channels there were for getting any sort of message or information to the public. And much of what's happened since around 1995, but really in acceleration after 2000, is that that system of gatekeeping is falling apart. And newsrooms used to own distribution as well as the production of news. But now distribution has been, quote unquote, democratized.
It's why I can be an independent on the web, which is a whole lot of fun. But journalists like you and me feel something is not just an era that's coming to an end. It's a model of democracy.
Absolutely.
You and I believe that the press is required as a sort of immune system, the defense against viruses. And yet, as you're saying, we've been displaced.
Well, it's worse than that. I mean, we're going backwards in the spread of democracy. Around the world, we're going backwards in the development of press freedom. We have illiberal democracy in Europe growing, and in the United States, it's alive as well. And so it's not just that the media gatekeepers don't have the power they once did. That could be seen as a positive thing. But we're going backwards in political time to an era when mature democracies were like minor players in the globe. And our president is not the cause of that. He's not even the leader of that. But he is helping to persuade more and more leaders that they can disrespect the press or co-opt part of it. And the United States used to be a leader in press freedom, not only because it had the freest press, but it insisted on recognition of that right around the world.
Yeah. And the public conversation itself is having a sort of nervous breakdown, I feel.
Sure, as well as the whole concept of accountability. The notion of holding power to account is evaporating before our eyes.
What has Donald Trump figured out? You say his plan with the coronavirus is to have no plan. How can that be?
Well, I wouldn't even go so far as to say he's figured it out. He's just obeying his nature as a malignant narcissist and just doing what feels good or raging when he feels like raging. So I don't credit him with really having a strategy. And so because he couldn't face the fact that he wasn't farsighted enough to prepare for this event, he is declaring the event over. That's not a strategy. It's just part of his nature as a man. He cannot face up to what he has done. He's incapable of self-distance. He's incapable of discipline. And when you put all those things into the blender and you combine them with the powers of the presidency, you get the plan for having no plan.
Which is wing it every day at the news conference?
Which is to define 1,000 to 3,000 deaths a day as normal, create confusion about who's responsible for that, and fire up his supporters so that they stay with him in the election and create so much fog and opacity in the rest of the system that other people give up and don't even try to figure out what's going on, and maybe you depress turnout as well. So it's not really a design. It's just the working out of his mishigas, as we say in Yiddish, his craziness, onto the public stage.
Jay Rosen, you're a kind of journalistic guru. You curate this remarkable news site for years now, Press Think. How would you fix the coronavirus coverage?
We need to create public understanding of the basic facts about the virus and also about how to combat it. that remains the same. But it's very hard for our news system to register what is still true when what is still true is the most important thing. Well, I don't think Steve Bannon, President Trump's advisor during the campaign of 2016, is any sort of wizard or genius, but he occasionally spoke with insight about the methods that he and his leader figure were following. And he told Michael Lewis something I think is very important for understanding the Trump movement. Bannon said, "The Democrats don't matter. The real opposition is the media. And the way to deal with them is to flood the zone with shit." And both halves of that observation are important. The real opposition is the media means that you can stay in power by fighting with elites rather than accomplishing things through Congress and the normal levers of power.
Jay Rosen, a friend of mine pictures this in a high school classroom. And there's one big kid, he's loud, he's brash, he's the most defiant kid in the room. He makes the process impossible. Except the real model is democracy. When you reject argument, when you reject evidence, when you reject the old rules or traditions, we're all in desperate trouble. Are we not?
Totally. And we may not make it as a democracy through this.
30 years plus when I met you, the thought that by 2020, you would be saying, we may not make it as a democracy. I wouldn't have believed it.
Me neither. Chris, my intellectual world is in ruins. What I thought was stable is radically unstable. What I thought was accomplished is being unbuilt. The United States has gone from a leadership position to a point where it is being pitied. A free press, a free and strong press, used to be a common value that both parties and presidents of both parties believed in, even though they got annoyed with the press and were convinced that it was against them and spoke in private about how much they hated it, they still promoted it in the sense that it was part of the American system. So all of these things are shocks to the system and they're shocks to me.
I'm too in a kind of disarray about what I think, what I believe in, about the ideal of a people that can speak freely about everything.
Well, we're living the dark side of all of that now, Chris.
Let's live to see the light again. Jay Rosen, such a pleasure always to hear you.
Thanks. Take care, man.
Coming up, a close reading of that plandemic video. This is Open Source. We're talking about the booming traffic in coronavirus arguments online in a broader culture of conspiracism. Alex Jones, at his website InfoWars, has built and embodied the atmosphere of suspicion. Here in his own voice is Alex Jones making one of his more notorious claims about a conspiracy theory involving tap water.
What do you think tap water is? It's a gay bomb, baby. And I'm not saying people didn't naturally have homosexual feelings. I'm not even getting into it, quite frankly. I mean, give me a break. You think I am like, oh, shocked by it, so I'm up here bashing it because I don't like gay people? I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay. Do you understand that? Serious crap. I'm sick of being social engineered. It's not funny.
This spring, it is viruses and virology at the center of all our news, talk, anxiety, politics, and conspiracy thinking. Here is Judy Mikovits, author of the debunked plandemic video.
So I want people to understand, I want them to think. We live in a society where we're bombarded with commercials, big pharma. You know, we need to turn off these TVs. We need to, the media is 95%, you know, big pharma owns the media, our politicians. We need to dig deeper. We need to look in the truth. We need to start reading books again. Scientists don't ask questions. All I did wrong, my only crime was I asked too many questions. Really? In the United States of America, we're censored.
Judy Mikovits has found a real following. No matter that her plandemic video is called worse than misleading, among her big fans is the soap opera actor and YouTube personality, Bo Davidson.
All right, we got to talk about plandemic. it's a documentary, okay? So it comes from a place of a lot of times of personal opinion and personal experience and anecdotal evidence. But there's no question that this woman knows what she's talking about. No one is denying the fact that she is a very esteemed virologist. And that should be noted. This isn't just someone off the street saying, hey, I don't believe in the deep state and I don't think we need a vaccine. That's not who this is.
Anna Merlin is a staff writer with Vice and the book author of Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and the Surprising Rise to Power. She's done her homework on Judy Mikovits and that video, Plandemic.
A lot of things that Ms. Mikovits says about her career are simply not true. And a lot of the claims that she makes about the coronavirus, for instance, that it can be reactivated by wearing a mask, are not only unsupported by any evidence, they go flatly against the best medical advice that we have now. But despite that, it went incredibly wildly viral and, you know, is sort of continuing to spread even after Facebook and YouTube have taken it down multiple times in multiple forms.
Take apart the simplest facts that told you this is a phony. This is much more fake than real.
Right. So Dr. Mikovits has, or Ms. Mikovits, excuse me, has been claiming for a while that she was doing groundbreaking research on chronic fatigue. She's more recently claimed that she was also doing groundbreaking research on vaccines and that, you know, she made a powerful discovery that was too big for the scientific establishment to handle. And so she was thrown in jail without any charges. That's incredibly misleading. And right away, that is a sign that what is being said or what is to follow is dubious in nature.
Sum up the discovery as she saw it.
She basically claims that as a chronic fatigue researcher, she discovered that an obscure retrovirus found in mice is actually the cause of chronic fatigue in human beings.
Had she done any work on it? Had it been reviewed? Had it been rejected? I mean, she walked away from some of her own so-called research, but what was the fate of that discovery, so-called?
Basically, what happened was Mikovits and a bunch of co-authors published a study in Science, which is a legitimate medical journal in 2009, claiming that this mouse retrovirus XMRV was responsible for chronic fatigue. But the methods behind the study were criticized, and the paper was ultimately fully retracted by Science, which is unusual. Nonetheless, Mikovits has continued sort of insisting that she made this groundbreaking discovery and then was silenced by the scientific establishment for discovering something that was, you know, too powerful for them to hide.
Who is her interlocutor here in this video?
The director and interviewer in this movie is somebody named Mickey Willis. He runs a company called Elevate, which is a small kind of new age film company that was not well known before this.
They never hit solid ground with an argument, with a fact, with an allegation, with dates. And they are encouraging each other in some weird signaling. I didn't get it. Immediately, I felt sort of seasick.
Interesting. I mean, so a lot of people actually found the promotion and presentation of what Ms. Mikovits is saying really persuasive.
Except they didn't say what she was saying. And they were obviously reenacting some sort of police arrest with sirens and red lights. And I thought, wait a sec. That had to be produced.
Yeah, I mean, she says at one point, and this is a direct quote, I was held in jail with no charges, which is simply not true. The reason why Ms. Mikovits was arrested was because she was accused by her former employer of illegally taking computer data and property from the lab that she had just been fired from. Those criminal charges were dropped, but for her to say that she was held in jail without being charged is factually untrue. And that's something that's easy to check. And so right away, that's a red flag.
You summed up the story, and it's a sad story, really, like this. A scientist was involved in questionable work and allegedly far more questionable conduct involving the theft of documents and suffered the consequences of it. Is that it?
Well, something that happened here, though, is that after she was discredited, after her research was discredited, she was actually offered a chance to try again and was funded by the National Institutes of Health to try to prove her claim that the XMRV virus caused chronic fatigue. And she wasn't able to substantiate it then either. And so in a press conference in 2012, you can see Ms. Mikovits standing with the other researchers saying, it's simply not there, acknowledging that her thesis had been discredited.
Right.
But something happened after she seemingly acknowledged that her research hadn't been substantiated, and she started showing up in conspiratorial circles by about 2014.
So it's a case history of a career sort of off track, becoming a case history in conspiracism, shall we say. How did that happen and who moved it?
You know, this is actually a career trajectory that we've seen more than once. You know, the most famous sort of person that we can liken Ms. Mikovits to is Andrew Wakefield, who's the discredited former doctor who linked the MMR vaccine and autism, a link which has, of course, been disproven many times over. But Wakefield, again, after his research was sort of discredited, retracted, shown to be false in the mainstream world, then resurfaced again in more conspiratorial medical circles, claiming that he was being silenced for uncovering a truth, you know, too large for the medical establishment to ignore or respond to. So again, this idea of being a whistleblower who is drawing attention to these evils and malfeasance and cover up in the medical establishment is a very powerful narrative. And just like it worked for Mr. Wakefield, it's working for Ms. Mikovits.
But it came to an end for him, you say?
No, he's still making these claims. He's still a revered figure in the anti-vaccine world. A lot of these folks, you know, might face really serious professional consequences in, you know, more mainstream medical circles, but they do just fine in their second acts.
Who sustains it? Who builds it?
I mean, I think we have to draw a pretty big distinction between conspiracy peddlers and conspiracy consumers. We know that broadly, conspiracy theories are common. They are part of the national discourse. They're part of the world discourse. They've been a part of American history since its beginning. But we know that conspiracy theories are especially common during times of upheaval, during times of uncertainty. So it's not surprising that they are resurfacing right now when we are facing a pandemic unlike anything that any of us have ever dealt with in living memory, unlike anything this world has seen since 1918. And so during times like this, you can always find people who are promoting alternate theories of what's going on that are often profitable for them. And we've been seeing conspiracy theories about the coronavirus since the beginning, since it began circulating in, you know, December or January in China.
You say you can always find them, but give us a short history of what you're talking about.
I mean, we know that broadly, the people that I call conspiracy peddlers have been a really regular part of the sort of ecosystem and the cultural landscape for a long time. The best known is, of course, Alex Jones, who's the face of InfoWars, which is a sort of multimedia empire of suspicion. And Alex Jones, you know, got his start in the mid-90s, really by promoting conspiracy theories about the Oklahoma City bombing and calling it a false flag, which of course it's not. Conspiracy peddlers and folks who promote alternate versions of events are incredibly common. And in part, they're incredibly common because they can rely on a very long history of real cover-ups and real malfeasance by the U.S. government and other world governments. One of the major examples that gets pointed to over and over is MKUltra, which was, of course, a CIA mind control experiment, wherein often unwitting subjects were exposed to incredibly bizarre sort of pseudo experiments that the CIA carried out, often, you know, without their knowledge.
Recently detailed in a hair-raising book, I must say, by our friend Steve Kinzer, about Sidney Gottlieb, the poisoner-in-chief, and a real figure at Fort Detrick, Maryland. Yeah.
Right. So we know that the government has a long history of actual cover-ups, actual conspiracies, actual sort of outrages committed against the citizenry and against the world. And one particular place where that has always played out is in the medical arena. The reason why there are specifically so many medical conspiracy theories is because there have been so many actual medical conspiracies. One of the most infamous, of course, are the Tuskegee experiments, where Black veterans were allowed to remain infected with syphilis for decades after researchers understood the cause and cure for the disease, just to see what would happen. Unethical and sort of horrifying behavior like that has created this legacy of suspicion and distrust that recurs over and over, you know, every time we're dealing with a medical crisis or a medical emergency.
No surprise that Alex Jones is in this, but I was surprised that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been a significant part of the Judy Mikovits promotion. How so?
Yeah, he has been. So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is obviously was for a very long time a respected environmental lawyer and activist. He began making anti-vaccine claims. He would argue that they're not anti-vaccine claims. He would argue that he is simply seeking safer vaccines, which is not a characterization I would agree with. But he founded something called the World Mercury Project that basically made claims mainstream science considers to be false, that there is dangerous levels of mercury in vaccines. That organization subsequently changed its name to the Children's Health Defense, which is now an advocacy group that positions itself as a public health group, but frequently makes really outrageous claims, primarily about vaccines. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wrote the foreword to Judy Mikovits' book, which she promotes in Plandemic, and Children's Health Defense has been very active in promoting both the book and Plandemic.
Who else is promoting it?
I mean, there's been an incredibly sort of broad cross-section of people who shared this video, some of them from what we would call the medical conspiracy theory or health freedom world, and some of them from the QAnon sort of conspiratorial world. A sort of big booster of Ms. Mikovits and her work is an ex-YouTube employee who is now a major promoter of QAnon conspiracy theories. But Plandemic was also a little bit unusual in that it started almost immediately to get shared by slightly more mainstream figures like the comedian Larry the Cable Guy, a fitness Instagram influencer with a million followers. It sort of leaked out of the conspiracy world and into a slightly more mainstream world pretty quickly.
Mm. We're bearing down on Plandemic, the Judy Mikovits story, but we're talking about a world full of these YouTube videos of one sort or another. What's happening?
One thing that we know is that people are constantly looking for alternate and somewhat simpler explanations for complicated and frightening world events, especially right now. You know, this pandemic has no end in sight. There's no cure. There's no agreed upon effective treatment. And so it's not surprising that we have, you know, any number of false and sort of misleading claims being propagated about both its causes and its treatments.
What should be the countervailing force, authority, argument, even on YouTube videos? No, people, it's just not so.
Well, one thing that you can do is you can be maybe a more critical consumer of online media. For instance, and we kind of touched on this a little bit, Plandemic has a lot of red flags. There is one supposed expert in the clip who presents an extremely misleading version of her own backstory, which is, you know, not how science works. It's not how good information works.
Short form, is there an antidote for this virus? The video virus.
What we saw with Plandemic is that a conspiracy theory that has, you know, real emotional appeal can spread widely and then can be debunked just as quickly because, of course, you know, hundreds if not thousands of journalists and news outlets have written about the video and have written about the numerous sort of false and spurious claims that it makes. However, part of the problem is that we know that the more we talk about disinformation, the more unwittingly we might spread it, even if we're seeking to debunk it. So it's actually very difficult to figure out what we're supposed to do with videos like these. Another thing that NBC pointed out when they were reporting on the video was the fact that the makers and promoters of these videos know that they're going to get taken down and they use it as part of their appeal. They essentially say to their viewers, you know, this information is so dangerous to the establishment or big pharma or the deep state or what have you, that it's being removed, it's being taken from you. So in some ways, this sort of allure of hidden, secret, forbidden knowledge adds right to the sort of cachet and the mystique around what many people already found to be an extremely sort of appealing and persuasive video.
Anything to say about the music, the tone, the effects, the reenacted or made up arrest scene, cop
right
cars howling?
Yeah, that's actually an important point. I mean, one thing that we can definitely say about Plandemic specifically is that it's well produced, it's polished, it has high production values. There are a lot of conspiracy videos on YouTube and none of them go even half as viral as this one. And that's because they aren't as professionally made.
Don't watchers also say, wait a sec, are those real cop cars? Were those lights flashing and troopers, you know, on the march? Or was that all done in the back lot of a studio?
I mean, I think at this point, you know, most people who consume any kind of visual media are familiar with reenactment, are familiar with sort of the use of like cinematic voiceover and what's meant to be journalistic work. And so they're kind of going to accept that and just say, oh, okay, I understand this is a dramatization, this is reenactment, but it doesn't make the information less accurate or less valuable. So, you know, in a way it uses these kind of big cinematic effects without sacrificing credibility for its audience.
You wonder though, this is where the fake meets the real, and which is it?
Plandemic from end to end is filled with just absolutely outrageous claims, both about Mikovits's career and about coronavirus itself. But, you know, the beauty of anything that you see online is that you can actually check it. Everything is checkable. You don't have to rely on one expert or one viral video to make up your mind. And, you know, people who consider themselves really informed political and world observers who were completely taken in by one video should, you know, maybe consider who benefits when you do that.
Meaning just what?
You know, if you are completely swayed by one source of information and you don't check it out, you don't do any basic research to determine if even the simplest claims are true, then the makers of the video benefit, but you don't. If your purpose is to become more educated about coronavirus's causes and spread, then it makes good sense to check as many sources as possible, and especially as many reputable sources.
Anna Merlin, we're glad you checked that out for us and glad that Vice published you.
I really appreciate you being so thorough. Thank you.
That was the writer Anna Merlin. Coming up, the big man in movie documentaries, Errol Morris, with a review of the Video Fair on YouTube. This is Open Source. Errol Morris won a Hollywood Oscar for his Fog of War interrogation of Robert McNamara on Vietnam. He followed up with Donald Rumsfeld on Iraq. But he's more than just famous and prolific. Over 30-plus years, Errol Morris has been omnidirectional in his subject matter and stubbornly philosophical in his pursuit of truth with a capital T, in a world of mostly liars and self-deceivers. He was our first choice to review not just the video contest on YouTube, but also the state of mind in the audience. I asked Errol Morris at the start, what do you call this American condition in 2020 of generalized and hostile disbelief?
Paranoia? When does skepticism become out and out paranoia? Paranoia about everything. When everything is attacked, whether it's the quote-unquote lamestream media, it destabilizes. I believe it destabilizes even the most rational among us. You start to wonder what's real and what is fake. I have never believed that truth is something that's written on a tablet. Maybe you can be given a couple of mathematical formula that are necessarily true. But truth is something that you investigate. You try to look at stories and try to get to the bottom of them and to learn something about what is true and what is false. It's a process, an investigative process. And today, I feel that we're all at sea. I can still, I hope, think straight about things, but every day you wake up to a new sort of crazy litany of material.
That's exactly it. And it's a very, very uncomfortable feeling.
I would say, yes, maybe this is the age of conspiracy. They seem to be absolutely everywhere.
Big Pharma, Bill Gates, Anthony Fauci, 5G, China, of course. The list goes on. But have you figured out the order of it, the connection, even throwbacks to Pizzagate and more exotic conspiracies?
Well, I used to joke years ago, I guess it's an unfunny joke today, that I didn't really believe in conspiracies because based on my knowledge of people, they were far, far too incompetent, too much at cross purposes with each other to ever effectively conspire to do anything. Of course, that's really not true. There are conspiracies of one kind or another. People get together and decide to do something either in secret or sort of in secret. But today, almost everything is a conspiracy. We're in a mindset where we think that what we see is some kind of fake representation of what's really there. People are deeply uncritical. People are believing of the strangest kinds of things, whether it's flat earth or alien invasions or the power of vaccines to destroy the world, you name it. And they seem to be growing exponentially, year by year.
Hmm. You're known as a truth seeker, Errol Morris, famous for your documentaries, including the Oscar-winning Fog of War, and many other examinations of people who seek the truth or make a career of covering it up. You also work the other side of the street. You're a famous commercial maker, which is an entirely different sort of revelation and different rules and different perils. What is the process we're looking at here in these documentaries? I'd love you to unfold it as a filmmaker, the effects, even the interrogator of Judy Mikovits, the music, the, I'm sure, reimagined police cars, sirens wailing, special effects, the air of foreboding, terror, real fear under that show. What are they doing?
Well, they're manipulating the viewer. They're trying to provide something that is watchable, entertaining, but is that so surprising? Certainly not to me. To me, it's the content of what she's saying, mm-hmm. which is so disturbing. If your point is that somehow filmmaking tries to manipulate people into thinking one thing or another, of course you're right. Of course it does. But is that so surprising? And is that so bad? What's bad is that people don't think critically about stuff, not the fact that they're presented with material that tries to manipulate them in some way or another. It's an easy matter to go to the internet. You can go to science. You can read the papers that were withdrawn. There's dozens upon dozens of articles now analyzing the video and analyzing Judy Mikovits. That's the good side of the internet. The fact that there are commentators out there willing to take her on and to challenge what she's saying in this video. When I made The Thin Blue Line, which got an innocent man out of prison, came very close to being executed by the state of Texas, a different era altogether. The name of the game were a couple of major newspapers and television shows. It's so very, very different today. And different in both a good way and a bad way. I know more about Judy Mikovits now than I ever hoped to know or wanted to know, but it's out there and you can read about it if you choose.
Errol, we live in an internet age. Incredibly liberated opportunities for individual expression, belief, disbelief, but now under threat of an out-of-control disease in an atmosphere of well-based fear, also a trough of political confidence, a deeper dread, I think it's related, from a changing climate, rising seas, and this general awful fear that we may have seen the last of the world that we grew up in. Take that apart, if you will, as what are the real contributors to this very spooky atmosphere?
The important thing to remember is documentary is not a vehicle for truth. Filmmaking in general is not a vehicle for truth. Hmm. It can be used as a way of examining truth or falsehood, and it can be part of a search for truth. I believe that the whole enterprise of The Thin Blue Line was a search for some underlying truth that I was grasping for, I was searching for. To go back to Judy Mikovits again, obviously someone is proselytizing, someone is preaching, someone is telling you what to think. And as you correctly pointed out, there's very little argument. There's little substance. There's merely expostulating, hectoring, lecturing. And there is no search for truth at all. There's a search for undermining what we believe in. Is that a bad thing? Maybe not. But in this instance, is it an appalling and frightening thing if people don't look beyond it to what she actually is saying?
Can I say, somebody made an observation about Donald Trump that I thought was interesting. The way he manages his political life, he doesn't have to tell the truth. He just has to say over and over again that somebody else is not telling the truth.
He doesn't have to tell the truth. Well, first of all, would he be capable of it, even if that was part of what he wished to do? Part of looking for truth, I find, is trying to understand the nature of falsehood. The best way to find out something is to look for cover-ups, for attempts to deny the truth or hide the truth or elide the truth. Always been fascinating to me. I had a long conversation, or I've had a number of long conversations with Cy Hirsch about these very issues.
Yes, indeed.
He wrote two books very early on in his career, one about My Lai, and the book that immediately followed his book about My Lai was called Cover Up. And to me, it's the best book that he ever wrote. It's immensely fascinating because it's the story of how the army and the government tried to cover up what had happened at My Lai. And it tells you very much about how difficult it is to ascertain the truth, particularly when there's so many people invested in covering it up, in hiding it, avoiding it. I don't really, any more than the next guy, really understand what's going on in this country. I can be scared by it. I can be appalled by it. But do I understand it? Do I understand why people are so eager to embrace nonsense? I don't. I find it really, really disheartening and immensely sad.
Cy Hirsch was the guy in your movie Wormwood who declined to tell you all he knew, all the truth he knew, about this desperate character, Eric Olson, spending a lifetime trying to find out why and how the CIA killed his father, who worked for the CIA. Again, you're in this complicated search in the all the cracks and crevices of what's going on here.
Cy Hirsch is telling us that in searching for the truth, there are all kinds of impediments. There are all kinds of things that prevent us from finding the truth or from stating the truth, publishing the truth. That this search is a very complicated and tortured affair. It's a different issue than what we're talking about here when you have people just publishing outright nonsense. What Judy Mikovits has done is even more disturbing because she wants to turn herself into a martyr. I mean, I suppose rather than just simply being discredited or expelled from academia and research, much better to see yourself as a Joan of Arc character, a person who has been misunderstood, persecuted, and denied her right to be heard by the general public. I've been thinking of doing a series on conspiracies because since we live in the age of conspiracies, it's something that I would love to examine. How do these conspiracies gain traction? They wouldn't unless there's some deep desire on the part of whatever percentage of the population we're talking about, but a good percentage of the population. These wouldn't receive traction unless people were receptive to it on some level, enough people were receptive to it. I've just written an article about Donald Trump and the movies, quoting Anaya Snin. We don't see things as they are. We see things based on who we are. And again, a very frightening thought, a solipsistic thought, a thought where the whole world just becomes a mirror, a wilderness of mirrors, if you like. And that's been part of the enterprise, the human enterprise, for thousands of years, is trying to go beyond the veil of superstition and falsehood to find out what is real. And it's an ongoing battle. It doesn't ever end.
But to answer your question, why this culture of paranoia, of disbelief, it's too obvious to say, but I'll say it. I mean, we don't believe our wars anymore. We don't believe our politicians. We don't believe our economic system that is promoting poverty and alienation. We haven't summoned the courage yet to do something about it.
I mean, the horrible reality is that we live in a failed state, a failed democracy.
Is it over?
I don't know if it's over, but it's certainly extremely ill, perhaps even more abundant. Things clearly don't seem to work anymore. If 9/11 and the war in Iraq undermined our faith in so very, very many, many, many things. I lived, of course, you know, through the 60s and 70s, through the Vietnam War.
Me too.
Which was truly horrible and truly divisive. But this is worse. In Vietnam, I certainly had the feeling that there were people who believed things and were misguided. They believed in the terror of international communism. They believed in the domino theory. They believed in a whole number of things that I found truly specious and at the very least unappetizing. Today, it's worse. There are no moorings. It's like a free-for-all. And that's probably the scariest thing of all. I mean, I was pleased just this recent press conference that Trump gave where he stalked off in the middle of his press conference because two reporters had the temerity to challenge him, to call the bully to account. But my feeling is that the press has been far too timid, has been frightened, been cowed in ways that seem unfortunate, because I think at this time it becomes even more important to fight back and to press back against all of this nonsense and false claims that surround our world.
I'm not sure that's the whole story, Earl. I mean, I think the deepest problem is that the media and Trump have both learned how to profit on their fight with each other. The New York Times has built its base online by relentless attack on Donald Trump, and he has seemed to feed in the 16 election, and God knows what 2020 will prove, on the opposition of those people. That's the trap. It's not that there's no opposition. It's that it serves Trump.
Look, I have no idea what to do. I used to think I knew what to do. There's a passage in Borges that I've always liked about the Hysteriones. I believe that they were a sect, a medieval sect that did exist, and they believed that there was a finite number of sins that had to be committed before the second coming. So they abandoned themselves to a wild debauch, hoping to bring about the end of the world, to make it happen a little bit sooner. Because sometimes I have the feeling we're waiting for everything to die, but it's not dying half fast enough. It's hard to watch our democracy engaged in some kind of death struggle. I hope it's not true. I really, truly hope that we find a way to recover from this debacle. But I can't say that I am entirely optimistic.
Thank you, Errol Morris, Anna Merlin, and Jay Rosen. Please think of adding your support to Open Source. The best way is on Patreon, where subscribers can hear Adam Coleman's series of interviews on close reading in a time of social distance. This week, Harvard English professor Beth Blum about self-help reading during the pandemic. To hear it, go to patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by the Healthy Skeptics, Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath checks all our conspiracy theories. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.